We have four speakers this morning, five this afternoon. We're going to start with Jocelyn Bell on the reflections on the discovery of pulsars. Jocelyn?
And I think the mic is not even turned on.
I just wasn't speaking into it.
Yes.
Do folk need the microphone? Yes, people at the back say yes. Okay, I will try and stand still. Thank you very much. So thank you for the opportunity to be here and give this talk. I've done similar talks in a number of places and I recognize a lot of the audience. So I'm going to assume that you know a fair amount about the story of the discovery of pulsars. I'll say a bit about it, but not in the lurid detail that I usually do. And I'm going to focus on some of the other issues around. I'm going to start in 1957, and this is not radio astronomy, but it is still pertinent with lessons for all of us. It's late summer 1957 in Texas at the MacDonald Observatory. Mr. MacDonald, when he endowed the observatory, required it to have an open night for the public one night per month. And this is the open night. There's a young summer intern called Elliot Moore. Those of you who live in Socorro may know him. He's just completed a bachelor's degree in physics at Chicago, and he's at MacDonald for the summer, and he's helping the night assistant with this evening's public observing. And the story comes from him. The telescope was turned on the Crab Nebula, in particular on Minkowski's star, which we now know is the pulsar, but at that time was a star with a funny spectrum. And the public step up to the telescope one after another and say, "Oh, awesome, cool," whatever they said in 1957. And a young woman steps up the telescope and says, "That star's flashing." And the night assistant starts to explain scintillation to her. And she stops him. She says, "No, I hold an airplane pilot's license." This is 1957, for God's sake. And a young woman holds an airplane pilot's license. She goes on, "My job is to fly newly constructed aircraft from the factory to the customer. I fly at night. There's not much to do in the cockpit at night. I look at the stars. I know about scintillation. That star's flashing." The Crab pulsar has a frequency of 30 hertz. Some people can see that frequency. In fact, quite a few. In Canada, the mains power supply used to be at 25 hertz, which we'll call 30 hertz for the purpose of today's talk. And a fair number of people in Canada could see the lights flashing and the TV flashing. And Canada ultimately changed to what the US might regard as normal. Apparently, it is more often women than men that have this acuity. The sharpshooters have done some research on the matter. I think it's entirely possible that she did see the Crab pulsar flashing with an 82-inch telescope. The official line was there was no instrument to follow this up. It couldn't go that fast. How did they know how fast? Elliot has a hunch there was an element of laziness, but there was no follow-up. Elliot recorded the young woman's name. He subsequently lost that bit of paper, but he has told this story to generations of students. Follow-up anomalies. 1966. This story, I have to say, has gaps in it, and the gaps grow the more I look at it. There may be people here who can help. I'm not going to name the individual involved. He was extremely embarrassed, even though he's no longer with us. I will preserve his anonymity. but a lot of you probably know exactly who it was. There was a 408 megahertz survey being done, an all-sky survey, using large telescopes in Europe. They're in what they believe is their last week of observing, filling in the gaps, you know, to make it all sky, not gappy sky. And they're using pen recorders because there aren't computers, and one pen recorder is misbehaving. It sticks. At least this is what I was told by the gentleman concerned after he'd been bought about half a dozen beers. He was the astronomer on duty early one morning when that pen recorder started misbehaving. He thought, oh, hell. And he did what we always did with equipment in those days.
Excuse me, Ken.
He thumped it. And it stopped misbehaving. So he said, oh, good. He put on his coat and he went home to bed. He had actually been observing the pulsar 0329 plus 54, and at the point he thumped the pen recorder, the telescope had turned off the pulsar. How unlucky can you be? Now, the bits of this story that don't stack up. I believe the period of 0329 is about 0.7 seconds. According to their paper, they used an integration time of 1 second. So how did he see anything other than the DC signal? But he definitely was aware of the pen twitching in the version of the story he told me. And since he's no longer with us, I can't go back and ask him further questions. But he's on record of saying he's embarrassed at having missed the detection of this pulsar. October, November 1967, jumping from optical to radio to ultraviolet. Sue Simpkin, who's now at NRAO, was at that stage doing ultraviolet spectroscopy. She had time on the Kitt Peak 84-inch telescope, and Lo Vulture asked her to take a spectrum of Minkowski's star. She did. She said it was pretty boring. The spectrum of the nebula was lovely with lots of lines. But as she was observing Minkowski's star, she was aware of what she described as waves going out from the star. Now, Sue started life in Canada at the time when the Canadian power supply was at 25 hertz. Sue knows she's one of the people who can see this frequency. When she mentioned to Lo Vulture about this sort of wave, he said, oh, you must have been dreaming. But he was man enough a few months later, when pulsars were discovered, and in particular the Crab pulsar was discovered, to say, perhaps you've seen it, to her. And then 1967-68, but this doesn't come to light till June 2007. When ATNF get an email absolutely out of the blue from somebody in the US called Charles Schisler. He explains that in 1967-68 he was a United States Air Force technician at an early warning ballistic missile station in Alaska with intense radars. And it was pretty quiet, I think, and he used sometimes to play around using the receiving element, but not the transmitting element of the radar. And he... He identified a number of what he described as pulsing sources. Now, for further assessment of this, I refer you to Dick Manchester, who's worked quite closely with Charles Schisler. I'm not 100% sure that he saw what we would describe as pulses, but he definitely saw variable sources. And he wasn't allowed to publish, and he wasn't allowed to follow it up because it wasn't part of the mission of the early warning station. But this is why we teach undergraduate astronomy courses. He'd done a course at college, and he knew about RA and DEC, So he noted the RA and DEC of his pulsing sources, and he's just discovered the online Pulsar catalogue and discovers that at least 11 of his sources are in that catalogue, give or take the error bars. In particular, the crab. So he's very, very excited. He thinks he's perhaps made the first observation of the crab pulsar sometime in 67, 68. And again, I'll refer you to Dick, but I believe our assessment is that he's genuine and he saw something and it's likely true. And then the actual discovery, also in 67, 68, it was part of an interplanetary scintillation project using interplanetary scintillation to detect or find quasars. It involved us spending 2 years building the radio telescope. This is part of the construction phase, details on the antenna at the bottom of the slide. What is happening here is we were testing the impedance of some low-loss airspace cables using a slotted waveguide. And because they're expensive low-loss, you can't curl them up, take them into the building, so you do it literally in the field. And flipping cold it was too. This is the finished article. Again, a few more details down the bottom. It covered 4.5 acres. It subsequently got doubled to be about 4 hectares. Although built physically as a single unit, it was electrically in two halves, operated as an interferometer, phased with delay cables, and although we had 16 rows and could have operated the 16 beams, we could only afford 4 receivers, so we used 4 beams. I'd used transistors as an undergraduate, but on arrival at Cambridge, was told they were noisy and unreliable, and valves were the thing to use. So to study interplanetary scintillation, you need a short time constant, and that's really the key. We used a time constant of 1/10 of a second, which was a lot shorter than had been widely used up till then, and we were doing a survey of the sky. Cambridge had one computer. Martin Dreyer's group doing aperture synthesis had access to it. Every other faculty member had grad students. Mine included, and the data came out on paper chart, and there was miles of it. There was 96 feet of paper chart every day from that system, and after I'd operated the telescope for 6 months, I had over 3 miles, and I can assure you I have scanned every inch, every quarter inch of those 3 miles. This diagram shows the first pickup of a pulsar signal. We didn't know what it was at that stage. On the left, CP1919 is the pulsar, labelled with hindsight. Centre right is some low-level interference. They're quite hard to tell apart, but with experience you can. I could pick up a signal like this occupying about 1/4 inch of chart occasionally, where occasionally means about once in every 7 or 8 times we looked at that bit of sky. It was very intermittent. But it didn't look like a quasar and it didn't look like interference to my eyes, so it got logged as a to-be-sorted-out issue. After a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, finally got basically a blow-up of one of those signals, expanded by running the chart speed faster, and you can see on the middle trace the first pulse signal that we picked up. The bottom trace is man-made time pips 1 second apart. The top trace is the third pulsar 0833. You will also notice the notation, which I now very much regret. We had to call these things something, and it was a bit of a joke. It was not taken seriously, but unfortunately the world has tended to take it seriously subsequently, which is a bit of an embarrassment. It won't go away. For your interest, the name Pulsar was coined by the science correspondent of the Daily Telegraph, a fairly right-wing, broadsheet British newspaper, but with good scientific coverage. We hadn't thought what we were going to call them. When he interviewed us after the announcement, he said, what you're going to call them, and we looked blank. And he suggested pulsar, by analogy with quasar, which we already had. And the name has stuck. Certain watch company needs to be aware of this. Ron Akers has asked the question why this happened then and why all these other things happened then. And I've been thinking about this for several years. Don't think it was to do with the arrival of computers. They weren't really available. I don't think it was to do with the arrival of transistors. They weren't widely used, but they were coming in. Was it other aspects of post-World War II technology kicking in? I think it's unlikely because we're now two decades after the end of the Second World War. I wonder if in part the space race had something to do with this, drawing the attention of people to the skies. But my guess is it's because by then we had a critical mass of radio astronomers. It was no longer a minority occupation. There were a lot of brains coming into us. But doubtless we'll hear other assessments of this along the line. A few comments on the key factors in the discovery as I judge them. I had helped build the radio telescope. As a student operating the telescope, it was my telescope, my receivers, and I made it my business to understand its behaviour, its quirks, its anomalies. As I've already said, this was one of the first observations with a short time constant, so we're moving into what Martin Harwit called a new area of phase space, and that often delivers. I was a grad student with relatively few other commitments, so I had time and space to follow up anomalies, and I did, excessively thoroughly. How many people here have heard of imposter syndrome? Good, the number grows each time I ask this question. Imposter syndrome is what is experienced by people who are somewhat lacking in confidence when they arrive in a new job, new area, which they perceive to be extremely clever. Until I became a grad student, I had been on the fringes of the United Kingdom, mainly the Celtic fringe. And rather by accident, I find myself in Cambridge, this great southern mecca of learning, where they're all terribly brilliant. I subsequently treasure the phrase describing Cambridge cosmologists, frequently in error, but never in doubt. I didn't know it, I don't think it was coined at the time, and I wish I had, because I was really overawed. And true to imposter syndrome, I said to myself, they're all terribly bright here, I'm not that bright. I shouldn't be here, I can't hack this. They've made a mistake admitting me. They're going to discover it and throw me out. And in bad cases of imposter syndrome, the affected person goes on, I'd better leave before they throw me out. And in places like Oxford and Cambridge, we find some new students leaving because they believe they're going to get thrown out. Well, I'm slightly more of a fighter. I said, they are going to throw me out, but I will work my very, very hardest so that when they throw me out, I won't have a guilty conscience. I know I will have done my best. So I was being incredibly, boringly thorough, checking every funny signal that telescope produced, most of which had mundane, very mundane explanations. There was actually only one that I never sussed out, but everything else I understood. And that's why I followed through on this curious pulsar signal. So thanks to imposter syndrome. If we had had computers to computerize the search, would pulsars have been discovered? They were initially observed in the night sky, where you don't get interplanetary scintillation because it's solar wind based. I don't know. And today, given the masses of data, would something unexpected be discovered? And the other point that I want to make is, if you're going to find something outrageous, it's essential to have a good address. We sent our paper to Nature. The editor turned it round in 2 weeks. I strongly suspect he refereed it himself, but when I asked them the direct question, he just smiled. But he knew Cambridge and he knew the group. So there's a number of fortunate circumstances along the way. And I'm grateful for that opportunity, and I'm grateful to be here as part of this session today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justin, for that delightful. I'm sure if there's some questions or comments.
That insulting remark about cosmologists came from Zeldovich in 1963. It did exist when he got there. And he didn't mean just Cambridge, he meant cosmologists in general. Did you know him?
Yes.
He had many fine great
ones. Jill?
Jocelyn, when you were discussing the potential protection by the woman pilot, you asserted laziness as part of the reason for not following up. I wonder whether it might not have been the laziness, the fact that she was female.
Yeah, wasn't believed. Yes. Yeah. Elliot clearly believed her, but he wasn't in a position to persuade the person there who had a photometer.
Bruce?
Congratulations Justin, on tenacity. I joined that same group 10 years almost earlier and had a different perception, but the training in building and doing it is what I took to Sydney.
Yeah.
And in your talks on the failures to discover it, you still do not put Molonglo in there. Our failure was just not to have the audio turned up so we listened to our signal as well as put it on the chart recorder. Because as soon as we knew, it took Tony about 10 hours there to hatch up a receiver, turn up the thing. And the key point you did not add was the area of the telescopes that were now being built. Few people, it wasn't a number of radio astronomers, the ones who built large areas, and at 400 in 1966, we had two or three very nice observations of the Vela Pulsar, 2 to 10 Polanskis, but we didn't have the audio turned down. Thank you.
Ron?
Jocelyn, your talk just threw something up I hadn't thought about before. Why were you observing at night, since you were looking for interstellar scintillation?
We just kept the chart recorders running. I wasn't going to go out and be observing and switch the chart recorder off to put it to sleep.
But you looked at the data and you had no reason to.
Yeah.
Along like 3C48 used to scintillate all night.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What
frequency? Frequency.
One of the northern stars.
408.
Bruce would probably know better which one. But it showed interplanetary scintillation before 408. I mean, there's a long tail on the scintillation versus solid scintillation.
Okay, thanks again, Jonathan.
I'll just add one more thing. Tony Turbull took it up. He was the one who picked up. Alan Bourne got about 17 papers instead, and included about 6 Nature letters publications for his PhD. And the PhD delay, publication delay in Nature over those 30 days was about 4 days from reception to publishing.
Nature's
incredible.
Yeah. It's very exciting time.
There's some seats over here. down.